evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you. And if you'd like to join us anytime during the program, the phone lines are open, 941-3689. 941-3689 is the number from Oahu. And if you call us from the neighbor islands or anywhere else where you may be listening to the live stream, 877-941-3689 is the number to call. Tonight, we catch up with Ann Wright. The retired Army Reserve Colonel and 29-year veteran was also an American diplomat in a dozen countries until 2003. That's when she resigned from the State Department in opposition to the Iraq War and began her life as an activist. She's been at Camp Casey with Aaron Watada during his trial. She was on the Gaza flotilla. She has gone wherever her brand of activism has taken her, most recently to Yemen, Pakistan, Ireland, China, and Belgium. In Yemen, she met with families of Guantanamo prisoners cleared for release and still in prison. In China, she spoke at the Nanjing Law School on whistleblowers and Bradley Manning specifically. And in Belgium, she presented at the International Peace Bureau Conference, and that's just some of what's happened during her last trip. We're going to hear more tonight. Ann Wright is back home in Hawaii for a few weeks and here to talk about what she heard and why we are or are not hearing many of those same messages. Ann, it's good to see you.
Thank you. It's great to be back, Beth Ann.
Good to see you in one piece and back and here. You've done so much since our last conversation, of not necessarily in chronological order, but looking at, for example, let's just look at Yemen for a moment and some of the families that you talked to about Guantanamo Bay. We've not seen the closure of Guantanamo since all the conversation with the president in 2008 in the campaign and saying he would do it in 2009. And here we are all these years later, and it's not done. When you met with these families, obviously, they're angry. There's a hunger strike going on. So many things that are calling attention to the fact that some of these prisoners should be released. What do these families tell you?
Well, that they expected a little bit more out of the United States, that they never expected that their loved ones would be still in prison 12 years, almost 13 years after they were picked up. They talk about daily life without their loved one. We met with young kids, now they're 11 years old, 12 years old, who were born after their dad was picked up and put in Guantanamo. We talked to mothers, fathers, who tell us how many family members have died since their family member has been put in Guantanamo. It's really a tragedy on all levels. It's a tragedy for them on a personal level, and I think it's a tragedy for us in the United States on a moral, ethical, and legal level. You know, there have been something like 775 people, almost 800 people that were in Guantanamo since it opened on January 11th, 2002. Actually, while I was in Afghanistan, I'd helped reopen the U.S. Embassy there in December of 2001. And then Guantanamo opened for people that were being sent out of primarily Afghanistan, but as we found out later, out of Pakistan and out of other countries, as there was extraordinary rendition starting. So there were 776 people actually that have been through Guantanamo. Now there are 166 left. So that means that there have been 613 that have been released. There have been seven that have gone through some sort of a trial. Actually, five have put in a guilty plea before any sort of military commission took place. Two have been tried by military commission. Four out of those have been released. They apparently time served and they were released. Right now, of the 166, 86 have been cleared for release. 56 of those are from Yemen. So it was really one of the reasons that I went on a 7-person delegation to Yemen, was that to have nearly 1/3 of the people that are in Guantanamo coming from one country and 56 out of 86 cleared for release are from Yemen. We wanted to talk with these families. We talked to some families of people in Guantanamo from Yemen who are not going to be released, that the U.S. has said that these are too dangerous. They are too dangerous to be released. And we talked to their families about the situation and what got them into a position that the United States feels that they can never be released.
A lot of the prisoners who are still there, 104 of them are on a hunger strike. When you talk to the families about that, were they prepared to understand that perhaps this might mean their loved ones would die if that force feeding stops?
Well, and out of the 104, there are now 42 that are being force fed. The families are, you know, they essentially say, what else is there to do? What else can our loved ones do? They've been in prison now for 12 years. The U.S. is not letting them go, even though they're cleared for release. And what else can they do besides go on a hunger strike to keep attention of the world focused on Guantanamo? And on one level, it's pretty true. I mean, if we didn't have that hunger strike, most people in America would have forgotten the people in Guantanamo. There are Americans that are on hunger strikes, too, in solidarity with the people in Guantanamo. In fact, a good friend of mine from Texas, Diane Wilson, was on a hunger strike for 57 days until week before last when we had a demonstration in front of the White House, and she broke her fast that day as she climbed over the fence to the White House, which was her. I mean, that's a strong thing to do to call attention to. She was in an orange jumpsuit, an orange Guantanamo jumpsuit, and we were yelling at the guards, then the police saying, you know, this is Diane Wilson, you know her, she's been arrested here before, don't shoot her. And thank God they didn't, but it was another mechanism of getting publicity for the fact that all these people are still on this hunger strike and are still cleared.
So what do you make of the two senior Democrats, Feinstein and Durbin, who have been calling for us to end this force feeding of those 42?
Well, I think it is appropriate. You know, there have been other places in the world where there have been long-term hunger strikes. In fact, I was in Northern Ireland. I've been there twice this year, and I've talked to people who were on the hunger strikes there back in the 80s. There were 10 people that died in British jails, UK jails, part of the IRA that were in prison and who went on a hunger strike. And the British government at a certain point said it is their choice, you know, and for us to continue to force feed them is not right. And it is their choice of what they're going to do to themselves. And 10 of them chose to end their lives by these hunger strikes. And one could argue they got a lot of publicity for that. We still remember the name of Bobby Sands. We remember that what happened. It's horrible that anybody has to go to the point of killing yourself by not eating in order to get the publicity for the issue, the political issue that you're so concerned about.
You're listening to Anne Wright. We're having an update visit with her now that she's back in town for at least a couple of weeks. And if you have a question, the phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. She's been in Yemen, as we've just been talking about, also China, in Ireland, in Belgium, in Pakistan, and back here in one piece, and looking back at the trip and some of the messages that we are and are not hearing, and also some of the messages that we couldn't necessarily be hearing because we are not able to talk to some of those families. Are they at all reconciled, the families in Yemen, of some of those Guantanamo prisoners, to never seeing their loved ones again?
No. Like all people, they feel that they should be able to see their loved ones at some stage. The whole issue of having a prison in Cuba versus having people that the United States is going to apparently hold for probably the rest of their lives. In every other prison in the world, families can go visit their loved ones, even if they've been convicted of murder, if they're on death row, whatever it is. There are mechanisms where families can go visit. This is one of the places where families cannot go visit. They do, through the International Committee of the Red Cross, about every 2 months, there may be an opportunity to speak by phone, although the families were saying that most of the time the connections just don't go through on the day that they happen to be scheduled to do this. But no, I don't think anybody's reconciled to the fact that they'll never see their loved ones again. They are hoping that somehow they will be able to.
Although they've been cleared for release, as you know, we've talked about many times, to this point, they're still there. Any indication from those you've spoken with at whatever level, not just necessarily the families, of what it will take to have these prisoners who have already been cleared, just the ones who've been already cleared, to be released?
Yes, the U.S. government says that there needs to be a greater level of stability and security in the country of Yemen before the U.S. will release them. And the country of Yemen has to have a rehabilitation program similar to what the country of Saudi Arabia has. You know, there were two times more people from Saudi Arabia that were in Guantanamo than were from Yemen. That Yemen was the second largest number of people from that country. But Saudi Arabia had 160. Yemen had, I believe it was 80 altogether. Saudi Arabia does have a rehabilitation program. And the Minister for Human Rights in Yemen came to Washington about 3 months ago with a plan she wanted to present to the U.S. government of how this rehabilitation center would be built and what type of programming it would have in Yemen so that this process could start of returning people to Yemen. In fact, she had been on a hunger strike herself in Yemen about this. Unfortunately, she was not given any high-level appointments with U.S. government officials while she was there. So she went back to Yemen in a huff, as she ought to, and very concerned about whether or not the United States really means what it says, that it will allow these people to come home when there is a level of stability. And there are a couple of other intervening things. I mean, there have been two incidents that have happened coming out of Yemen that have been of great concern. One of them was that the Nigerian young man who had a pair of underpants that he lit on fire as his plane was landing in Minneapolis, he went through Yemen. And that apparently is where he got these on-fire underpants. And from Yemen came the computer printer cartridges that apparently were going to explode. So yes, there are issues with Yemen. There are issues because it is a country, a very poor country, where there are a lot of people who really have nothing. They have really no hope. They have no education. They have no medical services. And the country, the government of Yemen, which is getting hundreds of millions of dollars now from the United States for working with the U.S. on the issue of drones, assassin drones, because Yemen now is the place where the United States seems to be doing more drone attacks than any other, taking the place of Pakistan, where because, in my opinion, of a great deal of public opinion and a great deal of citizen activism in the United States, the Obama administration has backed off its signature drone strikes, which are if a person meets a certain physical characteristic, like a young man able to grow facial hair and wear a turban, he becomes a target for drones. And the United States, having killed hundreds and hundreds of innocent civilians in Pakistan, as they have in Yemen, and the Yemen government's acquiescence to the United States for the use of drones in Yemen, where it turns out that there certainly are some people who've been aligned with al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula who have been killed. But there have also been people who have been killed who are that the government of Yemen wants to kind of eliminate because they are a pain in their side on other issues, on other, because there are a variety of armed groups that are in Yemen and not just al-Qaeda.
We've also killed some of our own very recently, the four Americans that were killed. But if you held that issue in abeyance for a moment, and even if the drones weren't there, the fact that, as you say, Yemen is a very poor country, there aren't a lot of hopeful places for growth to happen. And if that's all tied into the stability of the country, so that in the case of the Guantanamo Bay prisoners, that they would be released, it almost sounds as if there isn't a path for them. I mean, we just saw some of the demonstrations for the pro-Morsi protesters who were there. Other demonstrations have been happening. The prisons in Yemen not in great shape. People feeling that there's really no place for them to go or to do. How do you create that long-term stability, and not just for the purposes of releasing the prisoners, but for the purposes of creating stability when we have what we see happening now?
Well, I would say that things like drone strikes don't help in any way creating stability. That indeed the better way to look at these things would be to help with the education of people in Yemen, to build schools, to have health clinics. There are sections of Yemen where the government reach, their own government reach is just not there. And those are the people that are most disaffected. They know the government, the central government, is getting a lot of money, international money, but it's certainly not pouring down or dribbling down to where they are. So it is the dilemma that we see in many countries, that a central government may take monies that the international community gives and use it for building up their own military, for doing things for their national intelligence security, and not getting resources out that can be used in the smaller villages. And we were told by a variety of people that that's where Al-Qaeda and a couple of the other armed groups that are there, that they got a foothold in these areas because they were the ones that would come in and they would build a little school and they would build a little health clinic. And while they people that we talked to acknowledged that sometimes it was a kind of a rough society, a violent society, they were that these resources were the only resources that these areas had seen
to build any kind of infrastructure.
Build anything. And we had one family that told us that while going back to the drones, she said, you know, I don't like to have Al-Qaeda around. I mean, because I don't like all the things that they do, although they had built a little school and they'd built medical stuff. But she says, I know that they've done some stuff that I don't like. But she said, you know, at least I can talk to them. But, you know, these drones that are buzzing around us now 24 hours a day, there's no one I can go to talk to. There's no one I can say, listen, I don't have anything to do with any violence. My son, who's 16, 14, 12, he doesn't have anything to do with violent stuff. Don't target us. Don't kill us. But she says, there's no way I can talk to them. So it's real, you know, it's a real problem.
You're listening to Ann Wright back now from yet another trip. If you have a question for her, if you have a concern about what we are doing in Yemen, we're talking about that right now on Town Square. 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Yemen wasn't the only place where you were during this trip, but obviously speaking to these families made quite an impression in trying to bring out a message that perhaps we aren't hearing in certain ways that we should. Was there one specific message that they asked you to please carry back to the United States and just let people know?
Well, I think the message is that as in most of these countries, you know, whether it's Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, that the majority of people that are in these countries are peace-loving people. They would love to have a stable, peaceful, calm environment that they can grow up in. They don't like the violence. And yet the parts that we hear in America are just, you know, the sliver of society that is being violent. But Yemen is a beautiful country. It has beautiful people in it. And to see that society being targeted by our drones and by our military action to the extent that it is, is something that I think is not really going to turn out for the best interest of the United States. I think that there will be long-term residual animosities because of what we're doing with the drones, as well as the length of time that we've held people who've been cleared from Guantanamo and are still yet in prison.
the case was made not long after 9/11 that in some ways we had set ourselves up for that. Do you see a parallel situation now that will come home to roost 10, 12 years from now?
Well, I think
I
think we're seeing it coming home to roost at various points. I mean, we just see the horrible thing that happened in Boston, where the Tsarnaev brothers, killed 3 people, wounded 200, setting up these horrible explosions. And yet the young brother, the one that's alive and was just arraigned yesterday, apparently inside the boat where he was finally found, he had written with his own blood, this is violence, the United States is being violent toward others, and this is violence coming back on America.
I mean, having said that, you don't excuse what he did.
Not at all. I mean, not at all. But I think it's we do see that there are people who are unable to, that are willing to take action because America has taken violent action. And we'll always go back to, 3,000 people died on 9/11. But when you really look at others who have died through this next 12-year period and where the United States has used military action and the numbers of people that have been killed in Iraq and Afghanistan and Somalia and in Yemen, these are things that are being remembered throughout the world by a variety of people and to include some of our own people in the United States. So I think we really need, as a country, we need to shift how we approach these dangers to our national security. There's no doubt there are dangers, but sometimes our responses to those dangers perhaps may be making us more vulnerable.
Are you disappointed in the administration's stance in our public policy, in our foreign policy, in the way that perhaps you thought would be different coming into the Obama years, especially coming out of the Bush years?
Mm-hmm. Definitely disappointed. I certainly am. The closing of Guantanamo, which hasn't happened, the use of drones, which is like almost 10 times more drones being used under the Obama administration than under the Bush administration. If you talk about some other things, of the level of surveillance that's going on in the United States, the eavesdropping that's going on us. I mean, that now it's almost like there's not one thing we can do that is private anymore. And yet it's only in 12 years that this has happened to us, that all of a sudden all of the rights to privacy that we thought we had before 9/11 are now pretty well gone.
Are you disappointed when you look at the Obama years and what came before them? If you have an opinion to express, we want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight we're talking with Ann Wright, former diplomat, former military career woman, and now an activist. She's been all over the world. We're talking about some of her latest journeys. And Anne, I know we've got a couple callers on the line. We'll put them through. But I also want to talk to you now a little bit about China after we take up a couple of calls. Oh, they didn't? Okay. All right. Never mind. I thought they were giving me a high sign that we had somebody on the line who wanted to talk to you right now. But I'm going to ask you the question about China then, because it seems that that's a good segue from what you were just talking about, for us to look at what you heard when you went to China. And certainly here we are in the middle of the Snowden affair, which seems a much more dignified way of talking about it. Perhaps you talked about Bradley Manning while you were there. Do you put them in the same category, Snowden and Manning?
Well, they both revealed what some consider criminal actions of the United States, of our own government, toward people in the United States and around the world. And so in that way, and they both divulge large amounts of information that the United States was keeping on people or the diplomatic cables and the military cables that Bradley Manning exposed. And when you look at what they both have said about why they did it, it seems that they were pretty similar in their concerns about what was happening. And
but with Snowden, he also said that he put himself at Booz Allen so he would have access, that there was sort of a plan in place, which seems to be a different situation than what happened with Manning, which is kind of why we look at them and say, should they be in the same position? Do we look at them both as being true whistleblowers, or was there just sort of an opportunistic position that one of them or both of them took?
Well, I would say that they both are coming from the same point of view, and whether Snowden put himself in a better position that he had more access to materials that he felt probably were out there that he felt needed to be exposed to the country and to the world, and Bradley Manning, who had a much more discreet, narrow job, which remarkably for a young private first class, allowing him access to virtually all of the diplomatic cables, more diplomatic cables than I ever saw in my career, this little private first class had access to in a system that I think was from 2003 and 2004, from when Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, arm-twisted Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, to let hundreds of thousands of military and Defense Department people have access to diplomatic cables. I mean, that was a recipe for somebody.
Set up something that could happen, which obviously did.
Yeah.
Ray is calling us from Kapolei. If you'd like to be next, 941-3689, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. Aloha, Ray.
Aloha. My question is referencing to rule of law in Guantanamo Bay. You know, if America's judicial system is so great, why do we hold people without trial for years and years?
Mm-hmm. Ray, I think you're exactly right. We have a judicial system, a civilian judicial system, where we can try people who've been charged with all sorts of crimes and all levels of security classifications of the evidence that supposedly will be used in the trial. To me, I see no reason that we should that the government should be relying on these military commissions, that we should put these people who supposedly have committed horrific things, they should go before, in my opinion, a federal trial process that's capable of handling whatever classified information is needed to be presented there. And that if they're convicted, they should be put in federal prison. We've got supermax prisons all over this country that no one has ever escaped from. It's not like people that live in the areas around these supermax prisons have to be worried about anybody escaping from there. So I think it would certainly help the image of the United States if we would not have these military commissions and put the people on trial, and everyone should have to go to trial. I mean, the reason they say that they're not going to try some of these folks in Guantanamo is because we've tortured them. And it's the torture. Supposedly, our law was that if you gain information from them, but through torture, you can't use that in a trial. And if that's all we have on them, then the government seems to be saying, well, we can't let them go, and we can't try them because our own illegal actions will then be exposed, which really, I mean, everybody in the world knows this, and they're holding it against us.
We talked with Professor Neil Katyal from Georgetown Law several years ago when, again, this was being asked, the question he keeps asking every year, why, how can this go on so long? Why? And never really get any true answers with it, particularly given the fact that, as Ray just said, if our judicial system is so great, why isn't it working?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's, you know, it's the politicalization of a lot of this stuff, too, that the Republicans and Democrats will not agree on this. And rather than the president, who, in my opinion, has the authority to go ahead and move all these prisoners into a supermax prison by executive decree, He's not willing to take the political heat that is pretty virulent. I mean, we all acknowledge it's a tough world in politics these days.
Well, we have callers on the line now. I want to talk to you, Ann. Going to go to Don calling us from Haleiwa.
Yeah.
Hi Don. Thanks for your patience.
This is a little off topic, but there was a recent Inspector General report that came out about the $90 billion that was appropriated for reconstruction in Afghanistan. And they were highlighting a lot of the waste. I think there was $40 million for Army headquarter building that will never be used, $80 million for a consulate building that will never be used, I think another $30 million for incinerators that aren't being used. And my question is, do we have anything in place to stop this? You know, if they appropriate it, they need to spend it. And how do we switch that to get appropriations for all of our soldiers who are going to need this money in the Veterans Administration to take care of all the problems that we're going to have to deal with over the next few years? That's it. Thanks.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, Don.
Well, it's an excellent question. I've been in Afghanistan not only from 2001 and 2002, but I've been back four different times, three years in a row, last December being the last time. And it's startling. I mean, when you hear the numbers, the statistics on how much money we've spent, and then you look at what has not been done, there's been a lot of graft, waste, corruption that's been there, not only on the Afghan side of it, but on the American side. And when you look at the staggering amounts of money that defense contractors have made, it's abominable. There have been some court cases against contractors. There have been some court cases against specific military individuals who've swiped tens of millions of dollars. There have not been any court cases so far against any Afghans that I know of. But we do know that the son of the former Minister of Defense, who had never had any dealings in the transport industry, suddenly got, you know, like a $100 million transport contract to move goods from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So there's plenty of that. And as Don mentions, here we have hundreds of thousands of young men and women and old men and women, because there have been military folks who've been almost my age, and I'm 65, and there are some in their late 50s and 60s who have gone to Afghanistan and were in Iraq and who are suffering from the effects of that, not only the physical effects of having been wounded, and many times very severely, and yet being able to be kept alive, as well as the emotional problems that people are coming back with post-traumatic stress. And I hate to say it, contracting out, because that seems to be where they get the most money, is through private contractors getting bids or getting the contract for some of these things, because the Veterans Administration certainly seems to be underfunded and under not enough people in there to really meet the needs of the numbers of people that are coming back with severe disabilities, mental and physical.
Let alone being able to create any sort of accounting transparency to see how this money is going for the Veterans Administration, and clearly what Don is talking about in Afghanistan, too. And as you talk about the corruption and the graft, is there any way really around that, or do we have to accept that some of that is really going to happen?
Well, there is a way around it, and you have to start out from the very beginning.
Don't give the money?
Well, you have to track the money from the very beginning. And if after 6 months people are seeing that, oh, well, there's $10 million that's unaccounted for and nobody's going after, nobody's tracking it down, then it's just going to keep piling up. I'll tell you, when I was in Afghanistan, to see and hear about the amounts of money that were flowing in there, I'd been in several military operations before where they were done on a shoestring compared to, and as they should be. I mean, we should not be just throwing money after problems.
Especially in a time of sequestration,
yeah.
You'd think there'd be a little bit more sensitivity to that, or even the fact that we've been talking about potential sequestration up until the time it actually happened.
But you have to also recognize the power of these lobbies that we have. And the defense industry is one of the biggest lobby that we have in the country. I mean, they make the most money. They get huge contracts, and they have part of their profits, so to speak, going back into lobbying the Congress.
We've got more callers on the line. People want to talk to you, Ann. If you would like to be next, it seems like everybody just woke up and picked up their phone. 941-3689 is the number, 941-3689, or 877-941-3689. Going to Mark calling us from Wailoa. Aloha, Mark. Thanks for the call.
Yes, hello. Just a quick question. When Eisenhower left office, he warned the American public about military-industrial establishment. And I know it's a hard question, but it certainly isn't Congress who seems to be able to protect our privacy. What options do we as a country, I certainly am not advocating what Snowden did, but what options could we possibly have to at least start guarding some of our privacy issues? Thank you. I'll take the off the line.
Thanks very much, Mark. So, I mean, looking at the military-industrial complex and whether or not we have any defense against it.
Well, the defense is supposed to be the people who represent us, and those being our congressmen and women. But they have been the ones that have gone along with the administrations, first with the Patriot Act, and now...
Sometimes they roll over.
Yeah, they roll over, and they are not protecting our privacy, and they're allowing this... each of the administrations who come in with... the direst of circumstances, that if you don't do this, if you don't let us spy on everybody, if you don't let us collect all of their emails, all of their cell phones, everything that they do, if you don't let us do this, it's going to be your fault. And we are going to let the world know if something happens that you're the one that voted against this, or you're the one that in the secret committee or the committee that meets to talk about this. And there, you know, there are these intelligence committees that we have in the Congress who have known exactly what's been going on all along. And they, they have to sign a statement saying they will never tell anyone. And we've now had congressmen and women who have come forward after Snowden, I think it was Wyden of Oregon has said, well, since it's out, I will acknowledge that we knew about this. But we didn't stop it. We didn't say anything. We couldn't say. And they say, we couldn't say anything because we signed this statement.
That they wouldn't divulge.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it takes somebody who may have signed a statement like Snowden who actually then says, well, it's in the better good for the country that I go ahead and divulge it. And I will at some stage, I mean, he said in his TV airing thing, you know, that he acknowledges that there are going to be consequences to this. And as Bradley Manning said, I mean, he said, yeah, I knew there were going to be consequences to what I was doing. But it was important that it be done because it was to protect the country, not to harm it. And yet we have congressmen and women who refuse to stand up and say that they go along. They get rolled by the administration. We really need some very spunky congressmen and women to stand up to these administrations to say, wait a minute, you can't do this. This is not that critical to our national security. I mean, how can you possibly tell me that the government has to collect every cell phone, every email, has to do all this? I mean, I wouldn't believe it if I were a congressman or woman, and yet we don't have anybody that's really standing up like that. And that's what we need. We need the Congress to push back against the administration and to have some common sense saying it just doesn't make sense that you should be getting all of this information. If there is a specific need, if there is, you've got to show us what that need is. And then we go to the court, the special FISA court, the intelligence court, and it makes the decision that, yes, you need this piece of information and you need to tap Ann Wright's email or her cell phone, fine. But you don't need to do Beth Ann's at the same time.
All right. We could go on that one for a long time. But next year, we're going to have an election. And there are already arguments that this election is going to be particularly upsetting. We're going to see things come out that will make the last election look like, in some ways, a cakewalk. Clearly, we're going to get a new president because he will term out. as you talk to people around the country, and you've already expressed your own disappointment with the president, are the Democrats going to be up against it this next time?
Well,
Or is that too simplistic an argument to talk about Democrats and Republicans?
You know, there's not a lot of difference between them. And I think it's the individual that ends up being nominated. And, of course, the nomination process itself is kind of something that kind of makes them all meld together. Their individual ideas seem to, by the end of a campaign, they all kind of mesh together. And we don't really see a great difference in the candidates. And the political process itself, which one would hope would distinguish these people and give you some real choices, really on these critical issues, are not giving us the choices that I think we need.
All right. So says Ann Wright. What do you have to say? 941-3689. 941-3689 is the number if you'd like to call us from Oahu. Use that one. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream elsewhere, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. These are all hard topics to talk about. They make us look at ourselves in ways that are very uncomfortable, that can be beyond difficult, and challenge a lot of what we were taught as children about what the United States stood for. Certainly for you, coming out of a three-decade career in the military and talking to people around the country as much as you have and around the world as much as you have, is it really another era of being the ugly American?
Well, I'm afraid it is. This last decade has been pretty harmful, I think, to the U.S. image and its reputation in the world. A lot of people that I talk with who have really been tracking the U.S. image over the decades will say, well, this is just a continuation of what America has been doing. But having come from the government, I really think this last decade has been very harmful for us. And on the moral side of it, the ethical side of it, the things that our country is now known for in the world, of indefinite detention, of extraordinary rendition, kidnapping, of assassinations by drones, of eavesdropping not only internationally but on our own people. Those are things that...
And not having backbone. I mean, looking at Syria and the fact that the president said, well, if they use chemical weapons, that will be over the line, and then nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So do we just not have the kind of standing anymore that we used to have in a way that's not redeemable?
Well, I think it can be redeemed, but it's got to have an administration that will stand up and take some hard decisions, and hard decisions domestically. The domestic politics, I think, are running our foreign policy. And I think an administration that says, this is better for our country, and I'll take the political heat for making the decision that I know is going to, that it's going to come back on me, that there are going to be political ramifications for this, but I think it is the best thing for us.
All right, we're going to go now and hear what Ross, calling us from somewhere on Oahu, has to say. Aloha, Ross. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha, Bethan. This is Ross Botev. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. Good to talk to you, Ross.
Good to talk to you. Great show. Amen to everything that you have said so far, and to your guest, Anne Wright. I have a simple proposition, maybe, to go to the Congress and the Senate. If they're monitoring every single email and phone call, we have to have a certain period of time after which all these conversations and emails should be removed, and there should be any overseeing institution to protect our privacy. So if there is no suspicious activity recorded by the agencies, NSA or whoever it is doing it, they have to discard and destroy all these phone calls, emails, so there is no total control of the society. I have lived under total control back home in Bulgaria during the socialism, and I'm very sensitive about that. thank you very much for what you are doing today on this show and educating the population. This is very important. Thank you.
Thanks, Ross, for the call. Now, in fairness, you know, they have said at the NSA that, you know, they may be collecting, but there are certain key issues that would cause someone to pop up or not, and that it's just sort of, you know, data. They don't really isolate, well, it's Beth Ann's phone or it's your phone or it's maybe it is your phone. I don't know. But the point being that they're not connecting it to people unless there's a reason for that.
Well,
do you believe that?
No, I don't believe it at all. There's just not been a whole lot one can believe in that our government's been telling us about a lot of things. And I would say that we need to be very suspicious of how they're trying to rationalize what they're doing. And I think Ross has a very good point. You know, internationally, the biggest uproar has really been on the international scene about all of this eavesdropping. And Angela Merkel, the chancellor of Germany, has been one of the harshest because she says, I lived under the Stasi. I lived under the state intelligence agency in East Germany. I know what it's like. And when any government collects this sort of material on its people, it's wrong. And when it's doing it internationally, it's wrong. And domestically, for sure. So I think Ross has a really good point. And don't trust what they're telling us about this.
All right. Let's see if we can trust what John calling us from Oahu has to say. Hi, John. Welcome to Town Square.
There. Thank you. My concern is with the super funds, their ability, the defense industry advocates and profit makers. You know, they seem to be able to pretty much buy Congress. I don't see how we're really going to save democracy at this point. Does any suggestions? I mean,
that's a good question, John. Can democracy, in the way that we thought we understood it, be saved?
Well, one of the things that we should be doing is working real hard to get that Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, overturned. And it'll have to be done now almost by an amendment to the Constitution that says that corporations are not people and that they don't have the right to get unlimited amounts of money into congressional campaigns and presidential campaigns. There are several organizations, one called Move to Amend the Constitution to not let corporations give huge amounts of money into elections. I think that's one of the first things that we have to do. And we have to make sure we know exactly what our congressional representatives are getting from these corporations. They have to disclose it, and I think it ought to be put in every newspaper, how much, you know, down to the $100, how much every congressional representative is getting, because it does come back in their votes. It really does. It's important that we know who's paying them off.
When we had Professor Theda Scotchbowl here from Harvard, she said that, you know, frankly, we're dreaming if we think that this is going to happen anytime soon, that Citizens United would be somehow overturned, and that we really have to find other ways of coping and other ways of looking at that transparency more from the bottom up than the top down. What do you see happening if we're going to look at it from the bottom up? What is it that people can do aside from feel just frustrated?
Well, but that is, this move to amend is from the bottom up. It is the grassroots saying we want to have a referendum on that. And in order to do it, you have to get all these signatures on each one of the states in order to have a referendum on an amendment. And it is a good mechanism for educating people in your community about who's getting what from these corporations.
Yeah. So it goes back to not being frustrated, but doing something
doing
with that
something.
Frustration.
That's okay. Right. Get up and do
all
something.
All right. Well, Barta is doing something. She called us from Kailua Kona. She's on the line. Aloha. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi. My name is Britta, Britta.
I'm sorry they gave me the wrong name, Britta. Glad you're
no
there.
No problem. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm pretty much calling to tell the guest mahalo for coming and sharing and helping us in this endeavor, and pretty much you're reiterating what you just said in regards to, you know, bottom up, and also, you know, I mean, we need folks like you running for office, you know, and just, you know, I don't know how you term it, but not really voting for that big money issue or the big money people, because if democracy still lives, then it's not necessarily you know, we have to use the vote towards that particular constituency. But mostly, thank you for sharing.
All right, Britta, thanks very much for the call. I'm sure you haven't heard that comment before, that you should be running for office, but her larger point is that somehow we're going to have to do a much better job of educating ourselves and taking the time to do that, which is not an easy thing for a lot of people to do when they're challenged by work and life and several careers and the rest of it, but that we're going to have to ask a fundamental question. How important is democracy
in
our lives?
Yes, it is. And I don't really want to run for office. I think I'm more effective being on the outside, pointing out things that need to be changed. That said, we do need to find good people who won't take the money and run. I mean, that they will do what's right for the country and not just for the corporations of the country. And finding those men and women who are willing to do this and then hold them accountable, because sometimes people change from the nomination process and the running for office, and then once they get into office, they go in a different direction. So it's really staying with it and holding people accountable for it. And we do have a 2-year election that'll be coming up next year for our congressional reps. So that's one place to really watch what's going on. And on the presidential side of it, of course, that's a much larger challenge, but it's one that I think that we all need to really be watching out for, because as the political parties start trying to get money to run the campaigns, that's where we have a little bit of influence over them. And good luck.
Yeah, for a lot of people, that's a tough thing to hear, because you're not giving anybody any easy way out, and not that you ever do, mind you, but the point being that somebody with some backbone is going to have to step up and stand up, and we need a lot of somebodies with backbone to do that, mm-hmm. if we're going to get out of this and come through it with something that we are justifiably proud of.
Yes, and sometimes it's not from our own congressional districts. That if you see somebody that's really, you think, doing a really good job, they're standing up for the principles that you think of, then that you think are important for the country, then making sure you contribute to their campaign to get them reelected. Because we do have sometimes people that have done a really good job, and then, you know, those who have been affected by the decisions or the votes that the people have made, they get them voted out of office. So trying to protect those that are doing the right thing in your eyes is very important.
So we'll ask you, how important is democracy, and who really has some backbone out there? Are you going to do more this next election than you did last time, in finding out more about the candidates and also doing something about promoting them? 941-3689, 877-941-3689. Going to Craig calling us from Maui. Aloha, Craig. Thanks for your
Hello.
Patience.
Hello. I hope you can hear me. There's some static on the line. Can you hear me?
We can.
I spent 3 years in Iraq. I've only recently returned. I went back and forth for almost 3.5, almost 4 years. But I'm going to be honest with you, even though I admire the bravery and the courage of this person that you're interviewing, I came into this mid-interview. It's fighting windmills. The amounts of money are beyond belief, but to zero in on my basic question, because you trigger so many thoughts from my own experiences there, I wasn't, let's just say my job description was human resources, and I'll let it go at that, and I've lived in the Middle East for large periods of my life. Is basically, it's to a great degree, a great deal of hypocrisy. I mean, Israel is a recipient of $3 billion a year, and no one will even question it. During that brief period when Mr. Obama, who I did vote for, actually questioned or even made any legitimate criticism of the Israeli government vis-a-vis its Palestinian policy, basically making legitimate criticism, he was accused of being an anti-Semite. I'm of the Jewish faith. I am a supporter of Israel, whatever that means, but I certainly have come to lose a great deal of respect for the, literally, the apartheid society that has basically grown in Israel. And if you cannot support a democracy, that Israel is a veneer of a democracy, but those of us who have lived there, I mean, the Israelis love to show what's happening in the neighboring countries like Syria and Libya and so forth. But the reality is we do support a country that basically supports and practices an apartheid South African style of administration. Even Arab-Israeli citizens are treated horribly. but nobody will touch the $3 billion a year. This is understood that this will not be tampered with. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, Craig, we'll talk about it in a second, but as you seem to have had a very eye-opening experience by living there, and you're saying that we are tilting at windmills, do you not see any way out at all? I mean, aside from Israel and the $3 billion and all
well,
of that.
Well, I'm not zeroing in on Israel because I'm an anti-Semite, or the Israelis are particularly...
Didn't accuse you of that, but the point about tilting at windmills and saying, look, you know, this is kind of hopeless. Why are you even having this conversation?
We are not a society that is politically aware like Europeans do. Due to the basic lack of literacy in the United States, people, especially young people, do not read newspapers anymore, do not have a firm grounding in world history or world cultures. And also, the American people are under assault. The middle class now is deteriorating in our own country. These lobbyists, these contractors, one of whom I hate to hypocritically say I worked for until I had a falling out with them and I ended up in Washington in litigation with them, you cannot imagine the pressure you're under not to say anything. I personally witnessed whistleblowers who were actually arrested by Army authorities in Iraq who pulled the plug on some of these scams that were going on. We saw things. I documented everything, and I brought it back, and the companies that I was dealing with, they just laughed it off. They knew you could do nothing. In fact, when I threatened to disclose this information to the New York Times, I was told that the full weight of the American military and justice system would literally make an S storm out of my life if I did anything.
All right, Craig,
it's a pretty frightening experience when you're
It sounds like it, listening to you, and we have just a couple of minutes left in the show, and I want Ann to have a chance to be able to address some of
that.
No, but I wish you'd call earlier in the show. We could have talked to you a whole bunch. Thanks very much for the call.
Well, I think Craig's got a lot of very good points there. I will say, just taking the last one first, this whole issue of whistleblowing. Fraud, waste, and abuse has been horrific for whistleblowers. A friend of mine, Peter Van Buren from the State Department, has been essentially railroaded out of the State Department because he wrote about and the State Department initially cleared a book that he wrote about what happened in Iraq and the fraud, waste, and abuse. They cleared the book. It was published. And then his security clearance was jerked, and he essentially was railroaded out of the country. The issue of Israel and Palestine, Beth Ann and I have had lots and lots of programs here of going to Gaza and the West Bank and my concerns, even going to the extent of being on the Gaza flotillas, because I believe that what the Israeli blockades of Gaza are wrong. And that it's
well, you
it's
let everybody have it. You yeah. let the American government have it, the Egyptian government have it, and the Israeli all in one conversation.
All of them, absolutely, because there's a need for us to be frank and honest about what's going on, and then we can do something about it.
All right. Well, I wish we had more time to talk about what we need to do, but Ann, hopefully we'll get to see you before you go away, and be in touch with you as you're other places in the world.
Thank you.
Doing what you do, Colonel Alan Wright. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us, too. I will see you tomorrow morning, bright and early, for The Conversation at 8 o'clock right here on HPR2. Until then, have yourselves a good evening. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Aloha.